Hello and welcome to Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. After our outing in front of the great British public last week, we're back in the more familiar and more intimate confines of King's Place Studio One. There's no Allegra because she's jetted on her green way to Copenhagen this morning, but she has left me with excellent company in the form of top columnist Madeleine Bunting and our chieftain in all matters comment, Georgina Henry. I hope you're both surviving the build-up to Christmas. Desperate times. Don't worry, we won't talk about Christmas for long. There's lots of politics to chew over. We'll be hearing later from our green guru, George Monbiot, who I've interviewed from Copenhagen about how the climate's being saved or not over there. But before we do that, we're going to just briefly consider the political climate where people are starting to discern change as well. Opinion polls have been showing the Tories' lead's been reduced to single digits, and there's now excitable talk about a snap election. Luckily, the eminently unexcitable Mike White is around to give his take.
White Noise with Michael White.
So, a general election on March the 25th instead of the widely tipped May the 6th. It was all over the weekend newspapers. Tory activists with whom I chatted in Cambridge on Saturday wondered if it was just a cunning Labour plot. Labour MPs suspect it's a Tory plot to distract from their own internal troubles. So I rang a bookie. Was it perhaps a cunning bookie's plot to take some daft punter's money and balance the bookie's books? No, it was a puzzling mini frenzy to them too, albeit quite helpful in making sure bookies don't lose too much money either way, the bookie told me. So, no explanation there then. Never mind. The Guardian's ICM poll further fanned the flames on Monday night. The 9th, or was it the 10th poll out of 12, to confirm that Labour's narrowing the gap. 31% to 40, said ICM. Why? Well, that's even harder to explain. Green Gordon, Carbal Gordon, Class Warrior Gordon, Alistair Darling's banker bonus bashing. It doesn't sound quite right, any of it, does it? Illies with what the Tories stand for is as plausible. Is Cameron a One Nation moderate, a Harold Macmillan, or a cost-cutting radical, a Maggie Thatcher? It's still hard to tell, Dave. So, will Gordon Brown go for March the 25th, not passively await his doom on local election day, May 6th? MPs in all parties are divided. Early means he can duck a budget, but he can't duck spending decisions again. Can he, say others? It's cold and wet in March, protest some. But delays give the Tories more time to spend their huge war chest in those marginal seats, counter others, and so on back and forth in the corridors. He'll funk it, he always does, says one MP Labour, recalling the notorious Bottler Brown incident in October 2007 when the new PM drew back from seeking his own post-Blair mandate. Will the economy look better in March, or better or worse in May? Mutter some. In truth, I know few MPs who think Brown can pull back a victory now, about as many as think the Cabinet can depose him in January and win under a new leader. What they want is not to lose so badly that it will take a decade or more for the party to recover. Myself, I doubt if 6 weeks either way will make much difference, so I think he'll sit it out till May.
The inimitable Mike White there, and while that was being played, Georgina and Madeleine were busily discussing whether there was a hip-hop quality to his voice. But to more pressing matters, George, can you see any logic in this idea of going slightly earlier?
Not really. I think we have to wait and see if there's any more movement in January or February. But I sort of think there is obviously a psychological boost to Labour because they can see it is narrowed a little bit. But any serious observer of these polls say things like they're no more popular than John Major was at this period in the 92 to 97 government. And that, we all know, turned out very badly for him. Don't get too excited. So play the longer game, even though, as Mike says, it's only a couple of months longer, because things just might look a little better. I think it's going to look quite grim after Christmas still, in spite of the fact that unemployment was down a little bit, or claimants were down in the figures this week. It still feels pretty gloomy out there.
There's a rather chirpy letter in this morning's paper from W. Stephen Gilbert in Corsham saying that if you look at all the local by-elections that are going on, there's one in Weymouth where there's a swing towards Labour of 30%, and they've got some other ones in the Midlands where it's very electorally kind of swing territory. And they're saying it's not just the polls, it's also these local votes.
I know, but local votes are so unlike the national picture. We know that. I mean, if the bloggers on the Guardian website or anything to go with, they all want him to go early because they just sort of think it's all over. And I just think that, in spite of the fact that I think it's probably a good thing for Labour because they've got a little bit of a boost, therefore they might try a bit harder. There's been this awful sense in the last 6 months of they're just sort of, you know, the will to lose in a way. So perhaps it will boost them a bit to actually go out and do a bit of fighting. But I don't think it's going to make any difference in the long run.
What strikes me as odd about this argument is if the polls narrow sufficiently, then you'll think, well, maybe we can actually get ahead if they keep narrowing. And if they don't, then you'll think, well, we've got to keep waiting out. So I can't quite see the logic myself. But Madeleine, can you, if you take a few steps back, see any reason why Labour is kind of shoring up at this time?
Well, I think that I think the Tories have come under a much closer scrutiny. And as they do, I think all kinds of contradictions emerge, which I think is going to be fascinating. I mean, boy, oh boy, if the Tories do win, it's going to be one hell of a story. This is a party that actually has no common agenda, no common line. I can't really remember a time when a party has had such an enormous variety of perspectives. You know, prospective parliamentary candidates like Rory Stewart or Zach Goldsmith, right through to...
Free-thinking, greeny types.
Yeah. Exactly, with all of that, right through to sort of Alan Duncan and the kind of George Osborne, much more Thatcherite.
Business.
You know, and the interesting thing is the Tories have always been a party famous for discipline. Now, I don't get the sense that this bunch are very well disciplined. And I think that, you know, the prospects for an almighty series of civil wars over Europe, over tax cutting, and I think that maybe the public are just beginning to think, I'm not quite sure what they all stack up, what all this stacks up to. I mean, Mike gave an indication of it. You know, we still don't really know. Is Dave Cameron a Macmillan or a Thatcher?
Yeah.
And we haven't a clue because he bounces backwards and forwards with everything in between, hugger hoodie and Thatcherite kind of draconian public spending cuts. You know, this is a really kind of lucky dip.
Well, and he may as well then wait a bit longer, Gordon, because,
exactly.
I mean, on that thesis, the longer he waits, the more the contradictions show.
Yeah.
And the more likelihood there is of some massive row, as well as possibly the economy picking up a bit. I mean, I think it's also interesting that Labour has obviously somehow managed to get people to think, I think on the economy anyway, and the PBR, interestingly, which the ICM poll that Tom referred to was taken after, which we, the Guardian reported, like others, as having hit hard the kind of core voters really for Labour. Somehow that narrowing took place afterwards because the headlines about bankers, you know, rage over their own bonus cuts this year or cuts by tax seems to have sort of taken off the edge off that. But I wonder longer term whether or not people will actually begin to think, actually, he really screwed us. Or maybe it's because they thought more pain has been avoided because actually it could have been so much worse. Who knows?
I mean, one thing that dropped out of the poll I was quite interested in is that this national insurance rise, so the banker bashing is one thing, but the national insurance rise, which will affect people on £20,000 and up. So certainly not just the very rich, not the very poor, but just about everyone else. Now, among Labour voters, who are, of course, a minority at the moment, that actually had majority support. And I'm just wondering whether that kind of old line, investment versus cuts, is starting to get a bit of resonance because the Tories are talking so much about how they want to cut deeper and faster.
I think you've definitely got a point there. I think people have got used to a certain standard of provision in schools and hospitals, and they don't want to see that compromised. They do not want to go back to empty wards and, you know, tatty textbooks and leaking school roofs. You know, everybody can remember 15 years ago what tax cuts, what tight public spending looked like. Interesting, some of the vox pops that I noticed after the PBR were really drawing this out, saying, actually, I'm prepared to pay a bit more tax to protect public services that I really value.
Particularly as they don't actually have to pay the tax for another year and a bit.
Yeah. The funny thing about the bankers, I think George makes a really good point, and I hadn't kind of clocked this before. The banks, the city and the banks squealed like, you know, stuffed pigs last week, howling about a one-off, pretty kind of, you know, tokenistic tax penalty on their bonuses. But the squealing of the banks actually really played to the benefit of Brown, because it looked like he was doing something far more savage than he actually was.
That's right. And he sort of drowned up the noise about everything else. That's the fact it's delayed, as you say, for a year, therefore well after a general election.
Well, we'll leave the political climate there for the moment and turn to the real climate and the Copenhagen talks, which are going to save the world. These are the dramatic terms some people are discussing the issue in terms of, including George Monbiot, the Guardian's green guru, who earlier on gave me the lowdown on where the negotiations are going.
I haven't been allowed into the conference centre. I cannot describe the level of cock-up and hopelessness that's pervaded these talks. There were people who were standing in the queue for 10 hours in sub-zero temperatures, no announcements made, people fainting from exposure. I mean, some of them had flown straight in from Africa or India from very hot temperatures, were just standing there, and it's really a surprise that nobody died. It is utterly and totally farcical, and if they can't organise a conference, you wonder how they think they're going to save the world.
What's the issue here? Is it just space, or do you detect a kind of, you know, a drive to keep people out who are saying awkward things, which cock-up or conspiracy?
Well, I think it's mostly cock-up, because the cock-up started, the trouble started long before they began to exclude specific groups of people. But having made a formidable and amazing, fabulous series of cock-ups, they are now have been compounding that by telling journalists that if they speak to certain groups, such as those deeply dangerous subversives, Friends of the Earth, then the journalists could lose their accreditation. It's just incredible. This attempt to control the discourse here, and you know, a couple of things emerge from this, really. First of all, that they are simply not serious about engaging with civil society, and that they see civil society as a profound nuisance who they'd be better off without. And secondly, that they don't actually seem to be very serious about producing a proper conference, which could actually lead to a reasonable conclusion. Because, you know, if the levels of organisation are anything to go by, it's just not being driven forward. And my sense here is that the Danish government has been extremely half-hearted and pretty useless about this all the way through.
You've written this morning in The Guardian that Barack Obama is the one man who could theoretically break the deadlock. Could you just say for us where you think the central deadlock is, and secondly, whether you think there's any chance that Barack's going to heed your advice, turn up and break the logjam?
Well, I was rather hoping that if he was short of a speech, he could save himself a bit of time and a few fees for the speechwriters by just taking this off the peg one I kindly wrote for him in The Guardian. But I dream on. The problem we've all got is that the US Senate is a complete block on the entire process of international negotiations. And the fact that there hasn't been a decision made by the Senate yet as to what their greenhouse gas cut is going to be means that nobody really believes that there's going to be an outcome, because we're all negotiating with, well, everybody's negotiating in this void of not having a clear policy coming from the United States. And the fear is that Obama can say what he wants and the Senate is just going to block him. And the way I see it is that one of the world's most urgent problems, which affects not just climate change but many other issues as well, is the absence of effective campaign finance reform on Capitol Hill. And while senators can be bought and sold by energy companies and can owe their entire political career to funding from oil and gas and coal companies, then there's really no chance of getting a reasonable global deal. And the United States, which should be at the forefront of this, is actually dragging everybody backwards.
That's a grim analysis indeed. But if we just bring it back for 1 minute to the British political scene, we've heard David Cameron this week talking about localism as the way to solve climate change. Sounds a little bit hopeful. But I think you've been talking to John Prescott out there, who's been banging the drum for Labour. What did he have to say?
Yes, well, John seems to be one of those people like John Gummer or even Al Gore, who's a lot better at governing once he's out of office.
Yeah,
and he's saying some really good things, you know, and you get the sense that just like those other two characters, now that he's free, now that he can be the person he always wanted to be, and he's not subject to the ridiculous constraints of party politics and of being a member of a government. He can actually be a fully formed human being, and he's turned into quite a charming one. Actually, he seems to be a very affable and nice guy these days, and he has what I think is probably undue optimism about the outcome of the talks, but then he has got more experience of this than probably anyone else on earth. He was a key negotiator during the Kyoto process. He's been following this entire process. Some people are describing him as the father of Kyoto. And he says, look, what happens is it all gets left to the last minute. There's this total panic. It might go on into the small hours of the night, though they say they're not going to do that this time. And they basically keep negotiating until the last man drops, and then finally there's an agreement. But of course, the agreement you get out of a process like that is generally a very weak and partial agreement. It's not the sort of clearly planned and spelt out agreement which would match the scale of the challenge we face.
So, green lessons from John Two Jags Prescott. Were you surprised by that, Madeline?
No, I wasn't actually, because people are forgetting that Kyoto was a really, really kind of close-run thing, very difficult, fought right down to the wire, and that Prescott was really, who was then in charge of environment, was credited with actually having done a really fantastic negotiating job. And we ridicule Two Jags, but actually, he's very good at banging heads together. That's
brokering
what he always
deals.
Did for the Labour Party. He brokered deals for Blair, and he did it globally at Kyoto, so I'm not surprised he's employing some of those skills now.
Georgina, it sounds as of the time we're recording, like the talks are stuck, Obama's about to turn up. Do you think it's naive to hope that politicians can go back and sell real actions as opposed to green rhetoric to their electorates?
Well, it's extremely difficult. I mean, I still hold, we all hold, don't we, a little bit of hope that actually, quite often at this moment in a really complicated negotiation, there is quite a lot of rhetoric around anyway to try and force people to actually make the deal. And so this is a really, it's sort of classic moment, isn't it? Sort of they've got, 48 hours left to go or whatever it is, slightly longer than that. And I think the talking up of quite how difficult it's proving might concentrate minds. So who knows what's going to happen, and one shouldn't sort of give up on it yet. I think it's a really difficult message to go back. But I also think, what surprised me actually following the coverage, not as a specialist, but looking at it over the last 2 weeks, is how much understanding and deep sense of what needs to be done there is. The deal itself is really
amongst the politicians or the people?
Amongst the people, the stuff coming out of Copenhagen, the people trying to put it together. Of course, there are these really, really, really complicated issues. I heard the Zambian environment minister last night on the news, and she was incredibly eloquent about how difficult it is for developing countries to sign up to the kind of strictures that the West wants to put on them.
George Monbiot was saying just before that the American Senate is proving to be the single biggest obstacle to progress here. But I don't know if you saw, Madeline, earlier in the week, as part of this opinion poll we had, we asked British voters what they thought. And they all believe pretty much that climate change is happening. But a rather large minority of them don't believe it's anything to do with what people are doing. And it's a natural phenomenon. And also, when we say to them, is this Copenhagen business important? They say, yes, it is. But more of them say, but the politicians need to keep growth in mind at the same time, rather than they just need to accept this is an emergency. Do you think that's a fair summary of where public opinion is? And do you think that poses pretty serious challenges?
Yeah, Newsnight last night had a very interesting little scenario where they did a sort of experiment in the kitchen of one of their reporters with a bunch of neighbours, and then said at the end of the experiment, the scientist said, OK, are you convinced now, to the neighbours? And swung them. I swung them really pretty decisively from sort of sceptics to saying, right, OK, I completely get it now. I think it's a very difficult thing. Are we half, do you look at the glass half full or half empty? I find actually Copenhagen astonishingly powerful, because what's being talked about here is gigantic. And when you think 10 years ago, people were still very uncertain about climate change. There was still a lot of argument about it. I was talking to somebody who's been very involved in protest, and he said in 1995 they set up a campaign called 90% Crude, the idea that you had to reduce carbon emissions by 90%. Everybody laughed at us, he said. And he said now it's actually right on the agenda of international negotiations. So I think we're actually, I'm astonished actually at the speed with which people are beginning to deal with this agenda. It's not necessarily fast enough, but it's still astonishing.
But you're absolutely right. Things like 80% reduction by 2050, this is mainstream establishment stuff now. But signing up to big cuts by 2050 is a different thing, isn't it?
Well, George is, of course, completely right about the problems Obama has in the Senate. Who knows where that's going to go? He's expended an awful lot of political capital. We've discussed it ad infinitum on these shows before, really, with healthcare and that kind of thing. And it's a really, really tough thing to take back, and that is the thing that makes you then go from your glass half full to glass half empty, because I think it's really, really hard to see how he's going to get through something meaningful through American politics. I mean, there's such a kind of problem with the American political system in dealing with these things, and for Obama to get anything through is really, really hard.
Back here, David Cameron's big idea is that it's going to be solved through more local initiatives.
The grassroots element of this, I think, is important. If the environment becomes about leaders lecturing people to go and sit in a dark room wearing a big, thick, woolly jumper and turn the heating down, we're not going to get very far. We've got to show people that changing behaviour can lead to real benefits for you, that if you recycle more, you get charged less. If you go ahead with the wind turbine linked to your community, you keep the benefit, you get the electricity bills cut. If you switch to a different car, you'll pay less in terms of at the pumps or by having an electric car. Let's let people make greener decisions and let them see the benefit of going in a greener direction. This is where I want to take the Conservative Party, and have done to a large extent, in the direction of much more local, much more green. Those two things really go together in so many of our policies.
Madeline, has the Tory leader got a point?
Well, I think it's a very interesting idea, which is actually springing up in many parts of the political spectrum. I mean, the transition movement, which is this sort of very, very sort of grassroots-based environmental organisation, probably pretty kind of left-wing, actually, in its heart, is absolutely passionate about the solutions here have got to be local. Energy can't be household by household. Microgeneration works much more effectively in local communities, and it's all about how you rebuild that kind of localism. So Cameron's picking these ideas up from actually, you know, what's traditionally been much more of the sort of left-wing of the political spectrum. And I find them really important. I think that kind of local cooperation is definitely going to be a big part of the picture. It's not going to be the whole picture. You know, clearly there are big, big issues that can only be tackled at a national and an international level.
It's international, really.
You need every level of engagement, though, because if you're actually really going to get communities to engage with issues like waste disposal or perhaps growing some food or, you know, really kind of issues about your environment in a very kind of immediate way, that is about local cooperation. Lewis, for example, has done a lot around energy generation for its town. You know, the whole movement you had where you banned plastic bags in one town.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of local action, I think, is going to be really important. It's not going to solve everything, but it's part of the puzzle.
George, you were not nodding there, but it strikes me as a bit odd, the idea that things can happen one town at a time when we need them to happen.
Well, of course they do. But I think the major cuts need to come through countries agreeing with each other. It has to be an international global. Yes, absolutely. And of course, but I think what it does do, and that this is why it's so important, I really think Cameron is onto something. If he carries it through, and if the money is there too, because it does need a lot of resources to set it up. The reason why it's important is because you have to change the mindset about how we live our lives. And actually, unless you make that relevant to people, and unless you actually have out those arguments about, you know, this isn't just all about hair shirts and this, that and the other. I know there are different wings of the green movement, and that's argued out a lot in there, but at least we're all having that same discussion. And that's why it's really, really important to do these local initiatives. That's why it matters that schools actually do, you know, energy efficient things, and because I think you have to sort of start education at all levels in order to then make these global agreements actually, well, first of all, it's pressure on politicians,
yeah,
and then at a global level to it has to sort of trickle down or up, I should say.
Well, here's hoping that in those remaining few days at Copenhagen, the negotiators have their heads bashed together by John Prescott or some other guardian angel. That's it for Politics Weekly this year. But don't forget, there's plenty more from George Monbiot and others on our special Copenhagen section at guardian.co.uk. Thanks to Georgina, Madeline and to George Monbiot for taking part today. The show was produced by Francesca Panetta and Pascal Wise. I'm Tom Clark, and goodbye for now.